Hey, folks, welcome to the podcast. This week, my old friend Jimmy Dore is with me, a great comedian, a political satirist, social commentator, host of the Jimmy Dore Show radio and podcast, and also author. Man, you're smart. You're right now. It's called, the book is called Your Country is Just Not That Into You. Jimmy, welcome to the show, man. Thanks for being on.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to be here. Good to talk to you.
Yeah. So we were hanging out a while back in San Francisco after you shot your special. We were talking about that in the hotel room with a bunch of folks that we know and your manager and stuff. It's been a while since we talked, but sort of this book that you wrote kind of really speaks to a lot of stuff that, like, I've been thinking, and I think a lot of people have been thinking about sort of how they feel disenfranchised on some level about the political system and the way things are working in America. And, like, what prompted, I mean, I know you've been sort of on that road of talking about politics in America, but, like, what prompted the book?
Well, first of all, thanks for that intro. And let me just say that, you know, that special that you were hanging out with me after I taped it in San Francisco, that went on to be chosen best of the year by iTunes and top five DVDs of the year by Punchline Magazine. So I just want to put that plug and pat myself on the back.
That's something. Well, because I saw this, I was there when you taped it, and I thought it was a piece of shit. So I was shocked.
Yeah, me
shocked.
Too.
I don't know who you paid off. No. Great. You should. It's still on iTunes. Obviously, people can get it if they haven't seen it. Right.
Right. Correct. But but the book came out of so the title of the book, called Your Country's Just Not That Into You. I come from a big family, 12 kids in my family. Yeah. And people always say you learn a lot about life growing up in a big family. And I think the biggest thing I learned is I'm easily replaced, right? Like, I knew if I died, it wasn't going to put a big dent in their plans, you know?
It actually frees up money and food for the other 11.
Yeah. I just couldn't imagine my mom sitting around, oh no, Jimmy's dead. What am I going to do now with just the 11 of you? So I have a pretty attuned antenna to when people aren't that into me, which is where the book title comes from. And I'm talking about the people who own the country, not the government, not the people in Congress or our elected representatives, but the people who own those people. And those are the people George Carlin called the owner class, and they don't give a fuck about you. And what I mean about that is they give us a pretend choice, even, because we're going to get whatever the corporation wants, Paul. That's the whole deal, right? So, for instance, the last election, they tell you it's important to vote. This democracy is very important, so you get to choose. And the last election, it was important because it was Mitt Romney against Barack Obama. And if Mitt Romney would have won, we would have got Romney care. But Barack Obama won, so we got Romney care. So you see how important.
Yes. Yeah.
You see how important it is to vote.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's true. And the other thing that's a pretense, and I'm culpable because I go on these shows, is, see, I think the worst thing that ever happened in this country is news channels, 24-hour news channels, because it's really made the conversation more divisive, because it's not really geared toward healthy discourse where there's a free flow of exchange of ideas, so that a Republican really gets to see what a liberal thinks and a liberal really gets to see what a Republican thinks, and maybe somewhere in the middle they meet. It's just about ratings and holding on to the people who are watching by giving them all the information that they want to hear. And so I feel like that discourse has the pretense of being a true discourse, but it doesn't. And it doesn't benefit the country at all. Do you agree?
I disagree with you 100%. I think the causes of that is that there is no left in America anymore. I mean, how many times do you turn on the TV and you see Ralph Nader on TV or Noam Chomsky on TV or a union leader on Meet the Press? You never see that, ever.
Right.
But what do you see? You see the mouthpiece of the military industrial complex, Wall Street bankers, and political hacks and insiders. That's all you see on television, because the news is not created for you. The news is a corporation, and the corporation creates that news for their other corporate sponsors. You know, when people say the news is liberal, that always makes me laugh, because why would the Walmart, military industrial complex, and oil giants be funding the liberal news that is supposedly undermining right. their corporate message, right? right? So that doesn't make any sense. What they're right. so the watchdogs are the media, and they're supposed to keep an eye on the corporations and the government to make sure they don't collude against the citizen. So what happened was, that used to be how it worked. What happened was the criminals, meaning the corporations, they got smart and they just bought the watchdog. So now we're left with nothing but corporate news and Fox,
right,
okay,
right. Which is Rupert Murdoch bought Fox and bought right. the watchdog that's supposed to be keeping an eye on Rupert Murdoch.
Right. So I mean, but they all the news media is owned. There used to be in 1980 there was 50 giant media companies that owned all the media in America. Today, 6 companies that all. So that means all the news you're seeing is coming from the same 6 giant corporations. Uh-huh. And I'll show you how that reveals itself to hurt us as citizens. During the run-up to the Iraq war, Phil Donahue was on MSNBC. MSNBC is considered the liberal news channel, the opposite of Fox News. Well, they're right. not, because they're owned by a giant. At the time, they're owned by General Electric, which General Electric is a huge defense contractor, right? right. So now we're getting our anti-war message from a defense contractor,
right.
which sounds as funny as it is. And that's right. why in the run-up to the Iraq war, the only voice against the war on MSNBC was Phil Donahue, who had the highest ratings on the network. And then they fired him because they said he had low ratings.
Right.
So that's there. So you're going to get as much liberal claptrap on MSNBC as defense contractors, oil giants, and Wall Street bankers can tolerate. So right. that's why there is no left in America. If there was a left in America, Barack Obama would have offered up the plan called Medicare to solve our healthcare problems, because that's the left's idea of solving our healthcare problems is Medicare for all. But he didn't. He proposed the Republican plan, the corporate plan that was devised in 1990 by the Heritage Foundation, the right-wing think tank. So why is that happening? Only thing I can think of is that the criminals own both parties and they own the watchdog, which is why we're left with the biggest income disparity since the Gilded Age, even though corporations are making record profits and we're in the middle of endless wars while we fire cops, teachers, and bridges are falling down in America. So yeah, that's what the book is about.
Yeah, you make a good point in an interview you did somewhere else where you say that with this with the subprime mortgage problem, the wealthy elite and the people in power found a way to blame the poor for the collapse of the economy and push all of the blame away for themselves. And I was fascinated by that analysis. Explain that a little bit more.
So what? Well, you'll see. You know, I try to tell people that if you ever find yourself being angry at someone lower on the economic ladder than you, there's a pretty good chance you're being manipulated by someone higher on the economic ladder than you. And I always point to my brother, who's angry at people on welfare. He's like, oh, those people on welfare, they have babies to get more money. They're all scammers. And I'm like, oh, yeah, Danny, they've rigged the system. So now they're the poorest people in the entire fucking state. Oh, oh,
I'm enjoying electricity. If there's only a way I could get rid of this comfort. Yes.
I'm with you. I'm angry at the fat cats at the bottom. So it's just funny to me, in the middle of the biggest ass reaming we've ever gotten from Wall yeah. Street and the military industrial complex, the corporate media and Wall Street has tricked us into being angry at immigrants and poor people.
Right.
And in fact, my brother says that's what's wrong with our economy. He goes, we had too many poor people buying houses they couldn't afford. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's what happened. A bunch of people with no money and no power somehow wrestled the economy away from Wall Street and then crash the motherfucker. Oh my God. If there was only a way billionaires could insulate themselves from the penniless,
yes.
there's got to be a way, right? There's got to be a way. And I say, if that's really what crashed our economy, a bunch of poor people somehow buying houses, I say we take all our poor people, put them on a ship, send them to China, tell them to start buying houses. And that's where the joke ends, because that's fucking ridiculous.
Well,
So that's what I'm talking about, how they've they've tricked us into being angry at poor people. They've shifted. Right now, Paul, we're sitting in the middle of a boom time for corporations.
Yeah, the stock trillions market, of dollars. Yeah, there's trillions of dollars.
Market has come way back. All the gains that we've made since the collapse of the stock market, all the economic gains, 95% of those have gone to the upper 1%. So we have a rigged system, which Mark Twain called the Gilded Age, which it was a sick society, but there was a thin glitter of gold on the top that made everything look okay. And that's exactly what we're living in right now. Okay. And so corporations are sitting on $5 trillion and they're not investing it in our economy because they say they don't have confidence. You know what I say? If $5 trillion doesn't give you confidence, I would try fucking dance lessons. So this is the world we're living in.
Yeah. It's like, The reality too is there was this movement of Occupy Wall Street, right? Which I sort of hoped, you know, I went down there and took part a bit. What did you have hope for that? Because it just went away, right? I thought the message was good. I thought that there were sort of the way the message was delivered maybe could have been better. But what was your feeling about that effort and why it went away or was not really effective at the end of the day?
Well, I don't know how you feel about Occupy Wall Street, but is there anything more disgusting than a bunch of filthy degenerates making a perfectly valid point?
Yeah, exactly. So and that was the right's big art. Like, you ever turn into – and I've been on some panels. I go on these shows where they're like, oh, look at them. They're like a bunch of – it was like you're utterly dated grandfather, like just not getting the message and just looking, oh, his hair's not combed. He can't be an American. It's like, oh, really?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know what? And they all kept saying, well, what do they want? What do they want? As if it was some unsolvable mystery as to why tens of thousands of people across the country were protesting a rigged economic system that left the average working person out of the profits. And then when the economy did crash, the government took those same taxpayer dollars and bailed out the motherfuckers who caused the crash, leaving the rest of the people who paid the taxes with bumpkus, right?
But that's a slippery slope a little bit. Like, were you? That was going to be my next question. Like, how did you feel about the bailout of the banks and of particularly the auto companies? Because there is the argument that, you know, it helped get people back to work, the poor, the lower class, whatever, you know, the middle class. Were you in favor of that? Did you? And in hindsight, do you think that was a good move?
So in hindsight, I'm in favor of re-regulating Wall Street is what I'm in favor of, right? So when Bill Clinton repealed all the regulations that the FDR had put on the banks, by the way, the banks used to crash the economy every 20 years.
Right.
Like, that happened all the time. The shit that they did over this housing bubble, they used to do it all the time over all kinds of stuff all the time.
Right.
And then finally, FDR said, hey, we're going to put in some sensible banking regulations. And son of a bitch, we had a stable banking system for about 80 years in America until Bill Clinton decided to jump in bed with the corporate bankers, or hucksters, as I like to say. They repealed all those safeguards. And within a decade, those guys created trillions of dollars in phony wealth, put the money in their pocket. When it crashed, the government bailed them out and they didn't lose a penny.
Right.
So that is what happened. So should we have bailed them out once the economy crashed? Yes, we had to save the banking system. But what FDR knew when he also did that was that you have to save Wall Street. You know, all that bullshit about, hey, we have to save Main Street as well as Wall Street. Well, they didn't save Main Street. They only saved Wall Street. They fired fucking municipal workers across the country, which government workers are still 1.5 million jobs short before than they were before the crash. So this is all bullshit, right? So I would have done the bank deal, but you also have to then give jobs to the people. You don't fire teachers, you hire teachers. You don't fire cops, you hire cops. You don't not fund road building, you fix the roads. You hire people to fix the bridges. That's what builds an economy. FDR knew you put demand side economics. You put money in the pockets of working people and they spend it, which is why when people go on unemployment insurance, that's a good thing for the economy because all that money goes back into the economy. Whereas when a small handful of people like the Walmart family and the upper 1% hoard all the cash, that cash sits and it doesn't get reinvested in our economy. It doesn't circulate. So it stagnates our economy, which is why we have what we have today, a booming corporate economy and workers not sharing in the profits.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
so
true.
So that's how I felt about that. We bailed out the car companies, which, you know, I don't was that good? Was that bad? All I know is that we got the money back and the company's still operating. So we got the money back. So I'd rather invest in a car company than in a bomb company, because it's amazing how we never even ask, how much is this endless war in the Middle East going to, you know, I'm so glad to see we're bombing again in the Middle East, Paul. I was so afraid we were going to stop.
Yeah, I know. So, like, you know, oh, trust me, I don't think there's going to be any shortage of that. You know, I don't see that line of business going out of business anytime soon. Do you? I mean,
no.
So
the idea, Paul, the idea that somehow poor people or Social Security or Medicare or unions are somehow ruining our economy is, again, the corporate bullshit talking point that gets distributed through the corporate media, which is ubiquitous. Remember, only six companies control all the messages. That is bullshit. They've got more money than they know what to do with. America, when John Boehner comes out and says we're broke, well, guess what? We're still the richest country in the world. We have an economy twice the size of China's, and we're broke? Well, something tells me either Johnny's full of shit or he's using a Texas math book, okay? Because they take... Right now, they're doing a thing called quantitative easing. They've been doing it for the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 years. You know what quantitative easing is? I'll tell you. That's when the government takes $50 billion. That's true. $50 billion taxpayer dollars. They give it to Wall Street for free. And that's their jobs program. That's called quantitative easing. They did it this month. They did it last month. They did it the month before that. So when they say they don't have money, they're full of shit. That's why I named the book that. No, they've got the money. They just don't want to give it to you because your country is just not that into you. They're into, when they say they're broke, they don't mean they don't have money for endless wars in the Middle East, prison construction, and oil subsidies. What they mean is they don't have money for teachers, cops, firemen, right, healthcare, or anything that might help someone in the United States.
Right. So where do you see, because I've been having this debate with some people, where do you see this sort of watchdog come riding into the fore? In other words, some could argue that, you know, the internet was going to be the leveler, right? Like they were going to the online blogs and the chats and the non-affiliated internet news agencies would be the ones that would sort of be the watchdogs. But I don't feel like that they've made a whole heck of a lot of difference either. You know, I
mean, well, that was the idea back in 1996. Bill Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act, which pretty much deregulated all communications. It used to be you couldn't own a newspaper, a radio station, and a TV station in the same area, right? Same market. They had diversity of opinion in the market because we used to understand that diverse voices add to our culture, right? So instead of having a monolith of a monopoly of corporate voices in our media, we wanted to have a bunch of diverse voices. Bill Clinton got rid of that. He got rid of the regulations on Wall Street. So when he got rid of that, now that's, again, it's the same few people controlling everything everywhere from coast to coast. So what was your question?
Well, I think you answered it in part. I mean, my concern is, which is your concern, I mean, other than the PBS NewsHour, there isn't really an objective watchdog. I mean, it's one of the things that, you know, Jon Stewart had Jim Cramer on, and there was that big dust-up several years ago on The Daily Show where he called Jim Cramer to task. You know, what happened was that basically Jon was making the point, like, where is the financial media outlets who are supposed to be the watchdog during this whole implosion of the subprime market, right? And his argument was that there was a hyperinflation contributed to by the financial, theoretically, the financial watchdogs, the media watchdog, because they were have these CEOs on, and they're kissing their ass. They give them softball questions. They never press these guys because they want to keep having the chairman of Walmart on, right? So they're not gonna make this guy squirm, right? And you know, Kramer and these guys lashed back at John, and then that became that big dust up on the show where you know he took Kramer to task. So if there are no watchdogs in the mainstream media as we know it, one of the ideas of the internet was that the internet was going to be the voice of the people, and it wasn't sort of going to be co-opted by big business, and so you were going to be able to get a more sort of objective point of view and interpretation of what's going on in the world, and that would sort of move the needle. And that doesn't, in my mind, it hasn't really made a difference at all, and it hasn't happened.
Oh, okay, right. So you're talking about the internet. So now, by the way, it really hasn't happened. What has happened is we've gotten Facebook, which has turned into one just big, you know, information aggregator and an advertising platform.
That's Facebook is a toy as you said, an advertising. It has no real social significance whatsoever, in my opinion. Anyway,
now there is. There are some news outlets on the internet that are starting to make a dent. Like, for instance, there's a company called The Young Turks. They have over 3 billion views. They tell them news as it is, the unvarnished truth. They have no corporate advertisers. And by the way, they're starting to try to buy them now. So The Washington Post and Jeff Bezos tried to buy The Young Turks. ABC News has tried to hire away their CEO. So everybody's trying. So now people are starting to wake up to the internet. There's some internet news people. And guess what they're trying to do? If they can't buy them, they want to shut them down. They want to slow down their feed, which is what net neutrality is all about, right?
Right.
So now we've got a handful of companies that give you the internet. You can't get the internet except you have to go through these giant corporations. I have to go through Comcast. And,
right.
All right. So there's like 5 corporations that you could get the internet from, and they want to slow down the Young Turks feed or anybody else's feed who doesn't pay them a fee. And if you can't afford to pay that fee, you don't get to see their feed. So we all know that's a bad thing. They're going to get rid of net neutrality because, just like I joked about at the top of this conversation, we're going to get whatever the corporation wants. They want us to have RomneyCare, we're getting RomneyCare. They want to get rid of net neutrality, it's gone. They wanted to get rid of Occupy Wall Street. They got rid of Occupy Wall Street. In fact, Wall Street bankers gave the order, and Democratic mayors from coast to coast told union cops to go crack the heads of peaceful protesters. And that happened. Yeah. So that's why I also called it, your country's just not that into you. It's funny how the cops, who are in unions themselves, never see themselves as part of the society. They always see themselves as some extra. Somehow you're not part of this, you moron. You don't think they're going to try and cut your fucking benefits when you retire? My dad retired from the Chicago Police Department. They immediately tried to cut his benefits.
Right. Well, so, this is a culture that ties buying a Ford pickup truck, a Chevy pickup truck, to being American and talks about sort of being born free. So, I mean, there have been such a manipulation of, especially in the South, of what patriotism means. And you know, the union sort of, you know, if I see one more fucking construction site building a bridge in some city that doesn't really need to be bridged, or repaving a road for the 8th time that doesn't need to be repaved, and they all got American flags on, and they fucking, and you know, they this jingoism of somehow after 9/11, being a construction worker is on par with being like Mother Teresa or a fucking fireman. And I don't know where that came from. But there's a very scary thing that's happening more and more in this country, whether it's at football games where you have military jets flying over at the open of the opening of the game, is this sort of wrapping the flag in everything. And what it does is, for some people, it's like this shield where then you can't question anything, because then you're questioning one's patriotism. And it's very troubling to me.
Well, you know, there's a general called General Smedley Butler, right? General Smedley Butler. And he wrote a book called War is a Racket. And when he died, he was the most decorated war veteran in the United States history. Right. And he wrote a book called War is a Racket, right? And what he said, you know, a racket is a system that appears to be something different to the people on the outside, and only a handful of people on the inside know what its true purpose is.
Right.
And he said this in 1935. He said that war is a racket, right? And he said that only a handful of people know what the hell it is. And then he knows that a handful of people get he said it's the oldest, easily the most profitable, surely the most vicious racket we've ever known. It's the only one that's international in scope. It's the only one in which the profits are reckoned in dollars and the losses in lives. And it's best described as something that is not what it seems to be to the majority of people, and only a small inside group knows what it is about. And it's conducted for the benefit of a very few at the expense of very many, and out of war, few people make huge fortunes. He wrote that in 1935.
Yeah, it's so true. And you know, I was on a panel on a show, and they had latched on to Obama saying that the Constitution was a flawed document, which it is. Thomas Jefferson wrote that it was intended to be a flawed document. Well, they latched on to that and just ran with it. He's un-American. We should impeach our president for talking about the Constitution like that. That's un-American. And on the panel, and I made the argument, look, it was amended 27 times. That should give you an idea that it was a flawed document. All right? Nothing. Right? It just became this sort of like this mantra that they were going to use to just hammer the shit out of this guy, right? Well, what ends up happening is there's an African-American guy on the panel, and he's a Republican. And he's like, oh, yeah, this is a flawed document. And I had to turn to him on national television and say, you of all people can't say it wasn't a flawed document. Up until a couple of years ago, you were three-fifths of – you were a torso sitting here. You weren't even a full human being. And he couldn't see the color of his own skin in front of his face because he was so blinded by this allegiance to the Republican line – and the liberals do this too, and to this jingoistic fucking idea of like what we're supposed to be as Americans, and that we can't question anything that would slightly seem un-American. And that's unhealthy, because then there's not a real discourse. And when there's not a real discourse, it just becomes everybody's self-serving interests at odds with each other. And that's my concern about this whole thing. This American patriotism bullshit argument that gets thrown up when somebody doesn't really want to have a conversation.
Well, that's, you know, Paul, that's cognitive dissonance, right? And that's, you see it, it's the right wing in America, and I don't mean conservatism. I mean the right wing. You know, they're fueled by their corporate overlords and stuff like that. They have created this alternative reality. You know, it was so funny when Stephen Colbert gave his at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. He gave his performance. He looked at them and he said, "Yeah, we all know that that reality has a liberal bias." And that I talk about this in the book, Your Country's Just Not That Into You. What conservatism, they don't like accurate information. They actually, now the people who are opposing them are people. So what they've created is all the news media is liberal except for Fox or Drudge Report, unless it's right wing in their bubble. So anything outside of that, you can discount, which is why they don't believe in global warming and why they deny science. And they deny anything that they don't hear from Rush Limbaugh or Fox News, right?
Right.
And it's not happening on the left, right? Because the left is still kind of getting, they're still in tune with reality. That's why but people, here's the big thing. People are like, well, why did that happen to the right wing? There's two reasons. Bill Clinton got rid of the Telecommunications Act, so now there's no fairness doc. There's no nothing, right? Mm. So now they're able to do that. They're not allowed to have Fox News in Canada, by the way, right? Anyway, so that's another story.
They're not? Right? I didn't know that.
No. So and
why?
And, the what? Second reason that's happening, because you can't lie on TV, you can't lie on the news.
Yeah.
So the second reason that's happening is this the Democrats became Republicans. It started with Bill Clinton. So people are like, why do they keep talking about his birth certificate? Why do they keep talking about Benghazi? It's because they have to oppose Barack Obama because he's still their opposition. But Barack Obama is a Republican for all intents and purposes. So they have to go further to the right. When Barack Obama, if he would have proposed Medicare, they could have said, okay, Romney Care, and they would have seemed rational. But instead, he proposes their plan, and now they have to pretend they don't even like their plan, and they seem like maniacs because we all see it working. And we all understand that it was their plan, right? They would love to oppose his banking plan. It's their goddamn banking plan. They would love to oppose his war plan. It's their goddamn war plan. He wants to bomb everywhere the military industrial complex has bombed. He wants to bomb. So he didn't put on a soft shoe and walk with the union workers in Wisconsin like he said he did. He is a Republican. So that's why this is happening. And you get this right wing bubble of just crazy facts, you know, that somehow Social Security adds to the deficit, which you hear repeated by Maria Bartiromo on a Fox Business Channel. Social Security doesn't add one penny to the deficit. It never has. It never will. In fact, the opposite has happened, that the government has taken money out of the Social Security Trust Fund to fund its government. So they have taken money from our retirement to fund oil subsidies and wars and bank bailouts. And then they tell us, because Social Security has an IOU sitting in its bank account, they say, oh, look, Social Security's bankrupting us. No, you fucking took our retirement money, you son of a bitches.
Right, exactly.
So
we're
getting is corporate news. And if you're not getting corporate news, a corporate point of view, you're getting unbelievably right wing news like Fox News, right? So, and forget that MSNBC is liberal. As soon as they say something that cuts into the war profits or cuts into their corporate profits, they're off the air. That's been proven. They got rid of Jesse Ventura. They got rid of Phil Donahue as soon as the Iraq war started. And it was revealed that in a memo, internal memo, that said they wanted to get rid of Phil Donahue because he was anti-war. That's coming from a quote unquote anti-war channel. So got to get this out of our heads, that the media is somehow liberal or somehow against conservatives or Republicans. The media is 1,000% corporate. They're all about being corporate. And what's screwing us right now is corporations. And what we have is a group of people called the Tea Party who used to only vote against their own interests, but now they're organizing against their own interests, which is another big leap for the right-wing manipulators.
Do you grew up in Chicago, a big Irish Catholic family. Your father was a cop. I mean, you grew up, your family was a Democrat. So we're a Democratic family, I would imagine, right?
Yes.
And, you know, you talk about sort of growing up in a tough neighborhood and segregation. And, you know, I grew up in an Italian neighborhood in Providence, Rhode Island, and it was the same thing. Like, there was a lot of segregation, and they started bussing blacks in, and we were fighting with them. We didn't even know why. Like, it was so stupid at the time. Like, you just, I'm not supposed to like black people because that's what people around me say. So, you know, for like, you know, when you're a kid, you just do what you're kind of told or learned behavior. Did that upbringing sort of come into play or did your views change over time from being, I mean, obviously you're not a segregationist or anything like that, but I mean, I've had friends grew up in, father's a cop, big Irish Catholic family in Rhode Island. He started to make some money and then became a Republican. I know you haven't done that, but growing up, you grew up blue collar, middle class. What was that upbringing like? And how did that sort of inform, did you always know you wanted to do stand up and have a voice and speak to issues? Or were you just, was this just something that you, you know, kind of latched on to later in life? Like, how did this all start for you coming out of that environment?
Well, it was funny to me. So I grew up, well, the way I described my neighborhood is that they were blue collar, really blue collar, you know, racist. And, you know, we were solidly Democrat. I lived in the city of Chicago. So the city of Chicago, that was the city of Mayor, the original Mayor Daley, right? Back in the 60s and the 70s. And he had created what they called the Democratic machine, which was a system of patronage, meaning if you organized and got votes for the Democrats, you would get a job with the city. You'd become a truck driver or you'd get something. You'd work for the park district. You'd get a work. So it was patronage, right? Mm. So that's how they got. So guess what? So Mayor Daley dies. And then they have two white people or have three people run for the Democratic nomination in Chicago for mayor. Two of them are white. One of them is black.
Oh, I love this story. This is
the two white people split the white vote.
Right.
The black guy wins the Democratic primary in Chicago to be mayor. So now all these white people in Chicago who have voted Democrat solidly their whole lives now have a black guy at the top of the Democratic ticket for mayor. And it turned out in my neighborhood, they all figured out immediately we're Republicans. So they decided to vote for the Republican that year, who was a white guy named Bertie Epton. He lost. He narrowly lost to Harold Washington. But that's how we got the first black mayor of Chicago, and how everybody in my neighborhood realized they were Republicans when a black guy got the nomination. So that's kind of a funny story. Yeah. So that kind of really, you know, I opened my eyes to racism, how it works in America, how quickly people who you would consider to be decent still are afraid of blacks. They're so and the hurdles that they have to get over, and how embedded racism was in American culture. I mean, you know, Barack Obama got elected and people said, well, look, racism's over. But no, it just ripped the scab off it. Right. I mean, for the 50 some percent of the people who voted for him, racism was over. But there's a big underbelly in America. I mean, for Christ's sake, the long form birth certificate. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know what that is, Paul? That's that thing nobody ever heard of till we had a black president. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
I have mine. I keep it right next to my KKK card. I don't know where you keep yours. So that informed me. So and in my neighborhood, the people would work at jobs they hated all day long, but they usually get good pay and benefits, which they don't get anymore. But they would work at jobs that they hated really hard. They'd go to the bar after work, get drunk, and then they'd go home and watch reruns of All in the Family and laugh for all the wrong reasons.
Right, exactly. Not get any of the irony or get the point. And so did you start, how old were you at the time that this was all going down?
So this was my whole, so that election happened right when I got out of high school, but with the first black mayor. But the whole thing of, you know, I remember being in high school and people talking about reruns and All in the Family, and they were laughing at the wrong. No, Meathead was right, you idiot. Meathead was right, not Archie. They're rooting for Archie. So that was a big wake up too. So that's, that kind of informed. So I kind of knew there were, you know, as I call myself a progressive or a liberal, but I think what is the hallmark of being a progressive is I'm instinctively in tune to who has the power in any situation, right? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what I'm sensitive to, because whoever has the power in the situation then has the responsibility to make sure whatever the situation is gets worked out correctly.
Is that why you started doing stand-up, or was it just for the reason that most of us start? Because, you know, we like the laughs and that, you know, because I know starting out you were less sort of political in your stand-up, and then kind of transitioned over about, I don't know, maybe 5-10 years ago. What got you into it, and why did you get into it? And just give people a little sense of that kind of,
you know,
and
I just
how that changed for you.
When I was a little kid, I just always, you know, comedy, the classic story. I couldn't wait for the last 5 minutes of the Tonight Show, because that's when they brought on the comedian, and I couldn't believe that they made us wait for, and used to be 90 minutes when I was a little kid. It used to be an hour and a half. I'm like, and I would never make it. I'd always fall asleep. And I'm like, why don't they put that on at the beginning? It's the best goddamn part of the show. And then they save it. This guy's going to come out and doing comedy. Like, I would see a comedian do 5 minutes, and it'd be like to me, that was a real magic trick. Like, how do you do that?
Yeah.
How did he pull that off? That was amazing. Like, I could be funny at a party once in a while, but that's unbelievable, right? So I never thought I could do comedy. And then cable happened when I was in college, right? So I had cable and MTV and everything in my dorm room when I went to Illinois State. So I got to see a lot of stand-up comedy on television, right? They had the MTV Comedy Half Hour, VH1 Stand-Up Spotlight. And I remember the day I was watching somebody on VH1 Stand-Up Spotlight. And I remember who the comedian was, and I won't say his name, but I remember going, I know I'm funnier than that guy. And he's and he's on television. Yeah. I'm sure I could be a comic in the clubs. And that was what made me get on. So it was actually horrible comedy that finally gave me the extra push that I needed to get on stage.
That's hilarious.
That is exactly how it happened. So that's what made me get on stage. And then, of course, once I got up there, there was no turning back, right? I just was like, wow, this was the most exciting thing. And still to this day, the reason why I love stand-up comedy more than anything is because as I get older, I find myself always living in the future or in the past. I'm always worrying about the future. I have anxiety about what's coming. Am I doing things right? or regretting the past or guilt over the past or fretting over the past. And that's, that tends to make your life go by faster without it feeling full. So if I can get in the present moment, which is the key, if you are present, you know, like when you're doing, when they call you're in flow, that's when you know you're doing whatever you're doing correctly. Well, I noticed that doing stand-up, I have another hour, I got an offer to do an hour special about a month and a half ago from a New Wave, right? They would like to do another hour special, and they gave me a date, November 8th. And I was like, holy shit, that's quick. Usually you get a little more heads up. You know, you get like at least 6 months before you tape an hour special, and then you go out, you work it, you can tone it and tighten it. Well, I didn't have anything on the books, right? I had you know, just some stuff in town in Los Angeles, and so I started scrambling. So now I'm going out every night working it harder than I've worked in years to do stand up. And I'm noticing that I feel more alive than I ever have, because being on stage, I'm present. I'm not thinking about tomorrow. I'm only thinking about right now, that moment. So it energizes me. I feel more fully alive, and I'm having a better life experience, which what's what Joseph Campbell tells us is that people think they want, they're looking for the meaning to life, which they're not. What people are really looking for is the experience of having been alive. And that is what stand-up comedy gives me, which is why people do comedy till they put them in the ground.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I know you're doing a lot with your radio show, your podcast, and the book, but you're never going to stop doing stand-up, right? I mean, you're still actively doing it. And
well, that's what blows my mind, when people can stop doing stand-up.
You know? I know.
Which is it's a very curious about Conan O'Brien, that he never started doing stand up, right? It's very weird that he, you know, say, well, that he would go on and, you know, he does a monologue every night, and then when he toured, he played music. It's like, wow, that's just curious to me.
Yeah. People, there's comedy with a capital C, right? And then there's sort of that lowercase comedy, maybe stand-up, where stand-up comedy falls into that category. And I think that, you know, I don't think comedy, you pick it. I think it picks you, you know?
Yes, yeah.
You know, I mean, I had, you know, my previous life, I was a lawyer and a banker and left to be a comedian. And I thought I was picking it, and it was picking me, and I thought I was going to just play with it for a little bit, and I get it out of my system. But same thing, you know, I would love watching the comics on the Tonight Show or Letterman or whatever it was, and it was just like, I didn't care about the interviews, I didn't care about the musical guests, I cared about those. And I think that it's, for somebody like you especially, well, it's become a voice. It's sort of in the spirit of you know, the great satirists like Mort Saul and Lenny Bruce and Will Rogers, to kind of use it as a sort of a platform. Do you think you can effect change with it, or do you think it's sort of like, you know, tilting at windmills a little bit, you know, using stand up in that way?
You know, I'm not sure. All I know is that you know, when I saw Bill Hicks the first time, well, first of all, the first time I saw him, I remember I was pretty sure I had figured out comedy already, right?
Right.
I was a stand-up. I was a middle act. I had about 30 minutes of material, and I was the hot shit in Chicago as far as, you know, in my head. I was like, look out, here I come. Mm-hmm. And then there's this guy, Bill Hicks, came to town, and everybody's talking about him. So I'm like, oh, I'm going to go watch his show. Mm-hmm. I was first 5 minutes, I started to get nervous. Mm-hmm. And then after the 10 minutes, I started drinking. And then about 15 minutes in, I wanted to quit.
Because he was so good.
Yeah, because I knew, like, I always thought, like, George Carlin was always my favorite comedian. Mm. And I always thought that if I really worked hard and tried, that maybe someday I could do a special as good as George Carlin. That was my hope, that maybe I could. And that was my goal. But when I saw Bill Hicks, I knew that for the rest of my life, I was going to be competing for second place.
Oh,
and that really just, I don't know what, that was like a body blow, man. I just couldn't get over. And I remember I just went and got drunk, and I was sitting at this bar down the street from Second City that all the comics used to go to in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And my friend Steve Segrin just said that, he goes, that you're not him. Bill Hicks is Bill Hicks. You have to find out what you have to say and then go say it.
Yeah.
And it didn't sink in for a couple of years after Bill died, right? Because I saw these people trying to be Bill Hicks all over the country. Mm. And I knew I didn't want to be that. I didn't want to be an impersonation. I didn't want to go on stage smoking cigarettes like it was some kind of a big rule breaking thing that I was doing when my little sister smoked cigarettes. You know what I mean?
It's, right.
You
right.
know, that's not a big thing. You're not a tough guy because you smoke cigarettes. Right. So I developed my own style, which wasn't as confrontational as Bill. You know, my own style was more like I use sugar more than I use the carrot more than the stick in my stand up.
And yeah.
Now, and so I know how watching Bill changed my life. If I could have 1/10 of that effect on someone else, then I feel like my job is done. But my job isn't that. My job isn't to change anybody else's life or change anybody else's mind. My job is to, I have comedy inside of me. I have ideas inside of me and I got to get them out. You know, and that's all. I don't know what that is, but it fulfills some kind of artistic need inside of me that, again, makes me feel centered, present, fully alive. And if you find something like that, I would say do it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, your special coming up is going to focus on the political landscape. Did you have to give them an hour of material beforehand to tell them what you wanted to do, or they just
they got a set of mine, a video or whatever, a link. I sent them a link to an hour long set I did here in California about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, so I had sent it to my manager a year ago and nobody bought it. And then I said, hey, I'm going to go ahead and tape that special because I want to get those jokes down on tape before we have a new president.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, wait, let me send it over to a few places and see, which I thought he had already done.
Mm-hmm.
and then like the next week he goes, yeah, New Wave made an offer. They're going to do it.
Oh, great. So they want to see it ahead of time, basically.
Although when I did my first hour special for Comedy Central, I sent them literally, I think you and I were on that show together. We were doing a show in Farmington, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a Bob and Tom tour, so it was 2,000 people. And I went up, and I was supposed to do 12 minutes, so I stretched it to 16 because I knew I was sending a tape to mm-hmm. Comedy Central.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted a 20-minute tape, but I stretched to 16, sent it to them. They gave me the special off of that tape.
That was the hour special.
That was the first hour Citizen Jimmy that I did in 2008.
Right. But normally they want to see the full hour before they lock in, right?
Yeah. Well, like this time they did. Yeah. So it's, you know, each company's different. Like everything changes so quickly how they're doing specials. It used to be the network commissioned you to do it. Now it's the New Wave, which is a company that trying to shoot them and then they distribute them. And so it's different. There's Apple TV now. So New Wave's going to have their own button on Apple TV so you can watch specials. So it's a whole new world out there with Netflix and Amazon Prime. And you know, epics and whatever. It's a really different world out there, which is good for us.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's great. Well, I you know, this book is really fascinating, and people need to pick it up. It's where can they get them? JimmyDore.com or where's the best?
My website is JimmyDoreComedy.com, and you spell my last name D-O-R-E. And right. You can get it at Amazon. You can get it at it's an iBook through iTunes. You know, it's an it's a Kindle. It's everything. So. Go get it wherever you get a book. Go get it.
Your country is just not that into you. And also the Jimmy Dore show. Tune into that. When can people hear that? Can people hear that?
So that's a satiric. So we make fun of the news for an hour every week. I do it with Frank Connor from Mystery Science Theater 3000, and Ben Mankiewicz, right, from Turner Classic Movies, who also turns out to be hilarious. Not the old guy, the young guy from Turner Classic Movies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And,
I think he's going to take over for what's his name when he.
Yeah, I think he is too. So I do that show, and it's called The Jimmy Dore Show, and it's available at my website or iTunes. And it is by far the funniest podcast, satirical news podcast in history.
All right. Well, this has been great, man. And we got to get together when I come to LA.
Yes.
We'll hang out. All right. This has been Jimmy Dore. The book is Your Country Is Just Not That Into You. You can find it everywhere where books are sold. JimmyDoreComedy.com is his website. The Jimmy Dore Show is on iTunes or on his website, JimmyDoreComedy.com. Jimmy, it's good to talk to you, buddy. Thank you, man.